and look at the people that supposedly cooked up this agreement. And that's primarily Mr. Witkoff and a gentleman named Kirill something.
Dmitriev, I think.
Dmitriev, yes. This whole thing is vacuous and meaningless. If you don't talk to the people in charge in Russia to begin with, and at least established foundations for some commonality of interest and agreement, what do you expect to happen? Well, I think you expect nothing to happen. I think Witkoff was talking to somebody that had worked with Goldman Sachs and BlackRock. The man lives primarily in Palo Alto. He doesn't represent anyone in Moscow. As far as I can tell, he doesn't represent anybody in Kiev. So what do we get? We get this nothing burger, if you will, of 28 specious points that are irrelevant, that are not even open for discussion. That's the first part. Secondly, from the very beginning, I have wondered why President Trump pays as much attention to the Europeans and NATO as he does, because the European states and NATO are analogous in many ways to the Greek city-states at the time of the Roman Empire. Initially, the Greek city-states found this Philip of Macedonia, who was a descendant of Alexander the Great and his father Philip, reprehensible. They couldn't get rid of them. They were an oppressive, tyrannical group. And so they invited the Romans to come into Greece to help rid themselves of the Macedonian menace, which they did. The Romans threw them out, defeated the Macedonians, liberated Greece. And everything was fine until the Greek city-states decided to fight with each other. The Romans intervened again and said, look, we didn't liberate you so that you could kill each other and disrupt trade and commercial development in the Eastern Mediterranean. So we're taking over. We're running the place, which is effectively what we did after World War II. We said, we're not going to allow anybody in Europe to fight anymore. We're going to establish peace. These are the guidelines. The Greek city-states became irrelevant because they were just other members of the greater Roman Empire. Well, this is going to sound harsh, but that's true for Europe and the United States today. And the Europeans have gone to great lengths to make themselves permanently dependent upon us for their survival, not just militarily, but I would argue also economically. Now, that may change as a result of the recent events, but why should President Trump pay any attention to the NATO allies? He should get them into a room and say, this is it. No more war. We've had it. We're going to end it. These are the terms to which we are prepared to agree. If you don't like it, well, there are things we can do because you are dependent upon us. We can make life very miserable for you. That's what Eisenhower did in the aftermath of the Suez Crisis. He made it clear to the British and the French and others, if you don't get the hell out of Egypt and let this thing alone, then we are going to take measures against you, which are going to pull the rug out from you, out from under you financially. I guess my point is that for all the bluster, all the big talk that comes out of Trump, he behaves like a pussycat. Oh, won't you please sign on for this? We'd like your input. We want you to join us. The hell with that. We have no interest in this war in Ukraine. We never have. We have no interest in Ukraine other than stability and peace. That's what should have been stated right up front. Instead, we were dragged into this ridiculous anti-Russian crusade, largely because of the people that were running the Biden administration, and many of the people running this administration are no different. They adhere to the same principles, the same thinking. You know, it's not just Israel über alles. It's we're going to demand that Russia commit suicide before we do business with them. It's insane. It's all got to change. But he doesn't seem to be a free agent. He doesn't seem to be able to act decisively on his own in the interests of the American people.
Well, and so that's part of what's puzzling, because according to the reports, this 28-point peace plan wasn't just authored by Witkoff and some of his buddies, but apparently what's being reported was that Trump himself gave personal direction that this is what I want. So whenever, however they were arrived at, Trump said, yes, these are the 28 points I want. Then Witkoff goes to Europe. You have Secretary of State Rubio goes to Europe. And then all of a sudden things start changing. And as you've talked about many times, one of the problems with the current president is that he's really influenced by whoever the last person that talked to him was. And along with whatever was happening in Europe with Rubio et al., you also had Brother Jack Keane talking on American radio television, apparently also trying to influence Trump in a different direction.
We've got Putin on the other side of it. And the reality is he has not taken one single step towards a temporary ceasefire or a peace deal whatsoever. Where he is, he still believes that eventually he's going to break the will and resolve of the United States and the Europeans and the Zelensky government, and he will eventually have his way here. And that is the determined process that we're on here. Putting this peace plan together, hopefully with good security guarantees that certainly favor Ukraine as a result of the process, and some other things that we can do to help Ukraine, will convince Putin that negotiation is the best answer.
It's hard to put into words how the logic that's flowing from that, that we want to take, and you said it perfectly a second ago, what he is asking Russia to do is to commit suicide from a position of strength and do everything counter to their own interest, and then go with the peace from the guy who is on the lower side who doesn't have the capacity to change it. What in the world is going on in the Western thinking right now?
Angela Merkel, as Chancellor of Germany, and I'm by no means a fan of Angela Merkel. She did more to destroy Germany by opening its borders in 2015 than I think anybody since Adolf Hitler took Germany to war against the Soviet Union. But Angela Merkel did grow up in East Germany for the most part. She did learn something about the Russians. And she said on more than one occasion while she was chancellor that we need to understand that President Putin cannot conceive of any circumstances under which he cannot win a war in Ukraine. And she was right. If there's a war Russia knows it can win, not just Vladimir Putin, but everyone, it's a war on Russia's doorstep. It's a war in Eastern Ukraine or even in Western Ukraine, because you're talking about a force that can be built up and then ultimately commutes to the fight. Who cannot win in Ukraine? We can't. We're too far away. We can't mass the forces. We can't build up to do anything. And the Europeans, they lack both the resolve, the will, and the understanding to field a force that could defeat the Russians. So it's all nonsense. Anything that Jack Keane says about the war in Ukraine is nonsense. Forget it. It's a dead end. We can't win it. Now, I think privately there have been moments of lucidity when Donald Trump has effectively said that, when he said in the Oval Office to Zelensky, you don't have any cards to play. What he didn't know is that his donors were on Zelensky's team, and his donors were going to tell him, you have to stick with this, Donald, because his donors, these are the ones driving us to war with Iran, driving us to war with anybody Israel doesn't like, also hate Russia. Okay, it's not an American interest. But whose payroll are all of these people on? That's the question you have to ask. I wish every time Fox or CNN or somebody brings up an individual and puts the name up there, they should put beneath it sources of income. What are the sources of income? Well, it's probably Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, AIPAC, or some derivative of AIPAC. I mean, come on, let's be honest. Who is funding these talking heads? If Americans understood that, they would step back in horror and suddenly realize that none of these people are saying or doing anything that is in the interest of the United States. And frankly, this has been a problem from the very beginning. I saw this back in the 90s. The view was, it doesn't matter. We can sell our country down the road because it doesn't hurt us. We're great. We're powerful. No one can ever touch us. Nothing can ever harm us. So what difference does it make? What difference does it make if another few million illegals come into the country? What difference does it make if we embroil ourselves in conflicts in Africa, Asia, or Latin America, or Eastern Europe? Because we're great. We're powerful. Nobody can challenge us. Nobody can touch us. Well, that's wrong. It's dead wrong. And we are more vulnerable today than ever in our history. We have created a situation of extreme danger to the United States, not just militarily, but financially and economically. You know, someone was talking to me earlier today and said, you know, the problem, Doug, and this is someone overseas who's very heavily engaged in the banking industry. He said, you know, when people look at us and at the United States and then they look at China, they conclude very quickly that China's economy, which is doubled, tripled in size since 2005. Given its population, given the successful implementation of state-sponsored capitalism in China, even though China has a great deal of debt, just as we do, everyone is confident that the Chinese economy is going to outgrow its debt. No one believes, based upon what they're seeing inside the United States today, that the United States has any chance whatsoever of growing out of its debt. Absolutely not. And so the world is moving away from us into this thing called BRICS. And that puts everything at risk. So my point is that the people talking in these terms are not only dangerously wrong, they're putting the country in severe jeopardy. Because what we need now more than ever before in our history is peace and stability. The stability that comes from peace that is the foundation for prosperity. We need to dump all of this overseas and look very carefully at what we need to do here at home to rebuild our economy, rebuild this financial system to make sense, to end the financialization of our economy, to start producing and building things, which we have not done for decades.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And in order to make that vision come to pass, you've got to have a leader with the courage to make hard decisions. And unfortunately, President Trump, even though he came into office with that reputation, certainly has not produced. And I want to show kind of a graphic contrast, if you will. You mentioned a minute ago that Oval Office meeting in late February where President Trump had that big blow up with Zelensky and told him you don't have cards and you don't have leverage, etc. Had he acted on what you said he should have done in January and just said, all right, here's the deal. This is over. Our support is going to come to an end on this date unless you come to an agreement that we can live with, or you're on your own if you want to fight. That's what should have happened then. You said that many times. But instead, after this now, all these months later, now into November, this 28-point peace plan that he comes up with, now then that's been shredded, and you heard the parliament member there in Ukraine after meeting with Trump's negotiators said that none of the issues you wanted are on the table, and then last night, here's what Zelensky is now saying.
Ukraine is not alone, and this is important. Our teams have already reported today on the new draft of steps, and this is truly the right approach. Sensitive issues. Delicate issues I discuss with President Trump. Ukraine will never be an obstacle to peace. This is our principle, a common principle. And millions of Ukrainians expect and deserve a decent peace. We will do everything for this. We're ready to work as quickly as possible, and we also understand how many interests surround Ukraine. And, above all, there is an interest from Russia in derailing this chance for an agreement and in prolonging the war.
So he's trying to tell everybody, and of course he's been meeting with a lot of Europeans as well, that, hey, it's the Russians who are the problem, and they don't want the deal that we want, and we'll have peace as long as they're on our terms, which means, correct me if you think I'm wrong, is that whatever President Trump intended, it's Zelensky and his European leaders who are running the show.
Zelensky and his government are not only a catalyst for conflict with Russia in a permanent sense. Frankly, they are responsible for the conflict. And until that government is gone, there will be no peace in Ukraine or Russia. And that's where we are headed right now. People need to understand this. I think they do, frankly, outside of Ukraine. I think there are preparations to fly Zelensky and much of his inner circle to Israel, where they have immunity against extradition for criminal proceedings, and that's what they're going to need when they finish up in Ukraine. They've got one foot right now in Ukraine and the other foot really in the door of the aircraft to fly them out. People don't realize how weak and fragile this Ukrainian government is. Earlier today, I received some information from Eastern Europe, and I was told that people are coming out of the basements and homes in Prokhorovsk, and they're saying, to the Russians, thank God, let's get this over with, help end this war. And many of them are saying what initially back in 2022 in February, March, April, we're saying in Luhansk and Donetsk. What took you so long? I think increasingly the population that lives in eastern Ukraine and much of the population in the West desperately wants an end to this war. And they realize it will only end with one outcome. That is the elimination of Zelensky and his regime. It's a permanent trigger for conflict and war. Now, that satisfies certain people in Washington, D.C., and the current globalist governments in Europe. But it is not a long-term solution for peace and stability in Europe. It's the opposite. So people like McConnell or Slotkin or Lindsey Graham, any of these people, they all sing the same tune. You know, somebody was saying the other day, well, the Republicans have made such a mess of this. The Democrats are going to end up taking over on the midterms, and then they'll probably win in 28. And I looked at it and I said, so what difference? What's the difference? That's the truth. These people are all playing more or less on the same team. And that's why you've got to go back and ask the question, how is it that you're a millionaire? How did you become a millionaire after you came to Washington, D.C.? Show us the sources of your cash. Pretty soon you discover it's the same source, the same people.
And you know, you have to look at the European contingent this minute. You mentioned them a second ago, but again, this it seems to me that Ukraine and Europe are driving the train. You said it should be the United States. We have the power, but it doesn't look like it is. So on top of everything I've already shown you here now, kind of representing the European side, is Keir Starmer yesterday before members of his parliament, or maybe it's this morning.
And Mr. Speaker, we should not forget that Putin's aggression, his illegal actions, and his total disregard for human life has taken a huge toll on his own people. Thousands of Russian soldiers are killed every single day. 100,000 have been killed attacking Donetsk. In total, more than 1 million Russians have been killed or injured, all because of the depraved ambitions of one man. So, Mr. Speaker, we say again, this country will never falter in our support for the Ukrainian people. We will maintain a unity of purpose with our allies, and we will focus on delivering the calm, serious leadership that is needed to advance a just and lasting peace for Ukraine, and indeed for the whole of Europe.
Doug, seriously, that speech could have been given on the first year of war when Biden was in office. I mean, they're virtually indistinguishable, meaning there's no change, as you just said.
Well, these are all lies. And the lies are the foundation for the failed policies that he and his colleagues in Europe have pursued. If he admits that the Russian losses are minuscule compared with the enormous losses of the Ukrainians, well, that undermines his argument. It would be the humane thing for him to do, because he's just flat out lying. None of that is true. It reminds me of the commitments that were made by Franklin Roosevelt and Churchill that said Poland will be a free, independent, democratic state at the end of this war. Well, you know what happened? No such thing. It's almost as ridiculous as Gerald Ford, who during his bid for election, when he ran for president after having succeeded Nixon, said that Poland will never be a Soviet satellite under a Ford administration. And of course, it had been a Soviet satellite since the end of the Second World War. Politicians lie all the time. They lie when it's impossible to do anything else, because the truth is too dangerous. The truth is too destructive. Starmer is in a lot of trouble. He is the most universally hated person in the British Isles. He's not going to last. And frankly, Britain is in very serious financial as well as political trouble. If it all comes together, we could see something on the scale of the English Civil Wars. I commend everybody to listen to David Betts, who's studied the potential for revolutionary change in Great Britain now for many years, and his more recent works give great detail in support of what I've just said. So I wouldn't pay too much attention to Starmer. Macron won't be far behind, and neither will be Merz in Berlin. These people are all on the road to extinction.